Hey everybody, it's episode number 255 of Shop Talk Show, brought to you in part by HelloSign, which is very cool. And the HelloSign API, we'll tell you more about that later in the show, and CodePen, codepen.io. Go to codepen.io/pro to see all the pro features. It's going to be a rapid fire episode, just Dave and I answering as many questions as we can. Let's see how we do. Let's see what's in the old mailbag this week. We're going to talk about QA a little bit. We're going to talk about alt text a little bit. We're going to talk about gulp a little bit. We're going to talk about MVC and how you actually get data for your MVC app a little bit. Hopefully we get to all those. Those are sort of at the top of the list. And then, but there's like at least double or triple that many questions. Let's just see how far Dave and I get. How about that? Dave, sir, kick us off.
Hey there, Shopper Maniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. This is a rapid fire. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
What's up, everybody? Yeah, classic
just
one.
Just getting into it.
Yep.
Classic.
I already warned everybody it's going to be a Q&A. Just me and you.
Oldie but a goodie. No guests, no drama. Just us. All right. Hey, Chris, let's get into it. Let's not waste a single minute of this podcast. I've said too much. Let's go.
Go. Josh Smith writes in.
Well, let's just, through the magic of editing, we'll play that clip.
Hi, gents. My question today is about the quality assurance process. I've been struggling to make my QA process as efficient as possible. Currently, I work, I notify the stakeholders, they look, they critique, they send it back, rinse, repeat. We miss things. We don't always know what to check. They don't know what I just worked on. Sometimes I can't afford to write out exactly what I just did. That seems redundant anyway. We don't know who has already checked what. I want to automate. Basically, our no process is killing our efficiency. I need something more formal. I'm thinking a checklist with columns of browsers, some sign-offs, tools, some automation. I have some tools available like GhostLab and BrowserStack, but even those aren't perfect. I'd rather start out with something really strict, then back off as the team becomes more comfortable. But all the while, the process needs to be there to guide us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what works and what doesn't.
All right, so Josh's problem. It sounds really familiar. I don't know how. Okay, let's flip the tables. Chris, how do you do this kind of QA stuff at CodePen?
Well, I mean, what is QA? It seems like if you're communicating with your client, who has hired you to design their bakery website, and you design the page that describes how the muffins are made at Muffin Corp or whatever, and you send them an email that says, look, I worked on this page. Like, why is that such a hard email to write? That seems a little weird, you know? And like, I'm just trying to figure this out essentially. Like, if you need somebody to sign off on what you did, you should send them a link to it, describe what you did, and get the answer. But that's a little different than QA. That's just like asking somebody to just like take a peek at something and see if they like it or not. I think of QA as more comprehensive, but Josh, you mentioned that too. You mentioned like your stakeholder might not look at that page in 10 different browsers. They might not even do the old, at least check it on mobile and desktop, you know, roundhouse kick. And then they might not click on every single link that you can click on that entire page. They might not try to submit the form on that page. They might not try to do a million things, you know? So, but then it seems like, gosh, you're working on a bakery website, for example. Do I really want to set up Phantom and set up some like advanced integration testing for that website? Is that worth it or not? Is hard to know too, but if you're... That's what I think of QA. I'm like thinking of apps that need that kind of thing because there's a lot of users that use it. You know, like there was like a QA team at SurveyMonkey when I worked there that like nothing goes out unless it's gone through QA. And that was their job, mm-hmm. is QA, which seemed like, you know, it seemed at when I first heard of it, I was like, oh, God, really? And then now I'm just like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
I want a QA team, you know?
I mean, so I think QA teams exist because something went tragically wrong in the past. I think, you know, something shipped with a critical bug that cost money. It was bad. So people introduced QA, like manual QA systems, to kind of vet work and kind of, what would you call it? Like vet work and make sure nothing goes wrong before it hits the user. It's kind of like a, I'll say a conservative approach. Like your risk management, you're doing all the risk management up front. You're not letting yourself be like, yeah, just push it live to the server. And if it breaks, whatever, we'll figure it out. Like you're not taking that path, or your company is not. You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, at this point I think you do want to automate as much as possible. I think that's the tricky thing is, but what,
so there's automation, like a computer's going to automate it for me. And then there's automation, like a checklist, like manual automation, like at least make sure a human being has checked off these things, which is like, you did the browser squeezies and made sure nothing was screwed up. You clicked on all the links, you filled out all the forms, and like, make sure all those things are checked, which is a form of automation, but it stops short of literal integration testing. And I think you'll know what integration testing is. It's time, you know, and it's probably not $1,000 freelance project. It's probably not even a $20,000 freelance project. It's probably more like web app territory, whatever those things are.
Like somebody full time for a year to figure that out, sort of thing. You know, like I think you're right that you need to establish the process for any kind of like a small change process and maybe a big change process, or maybe it's just any change process.
Can people sign up on this website? Is that a thing that people can do? Because it's time for automation then, in a sense, because if you ever push a change that breaks sign up,
I've done this and I feel foolish. Like sign up didn't work for a week or something, 'cause I made some terrible change, you know, and like, or something I thought was stupid and it was just, it broke sign up. That's not good. You know? I think I would do, what we did, this was on day trip. We came up with the checklist, like every major thing, check this, you know? And one of the situations we were having was not even I change code. Like when Heroku installed gems, it does it from a clean slate, and it had more updated gems than I had. And that the new gem had broken the functionality. It took me a while to figure that out. But so we did like a manual check. We have like, you know, 10 things that have to work. Let's check. This is the walk of the user flow. And I think at, you know, after I have this checklist that you can kind of check off, or a bulleted list, I can now look at this list and be like, okay, what of these things can I make a robot do and tell me yes or no before I even ship or before it launches and goes live? So that's the phase I'm at now. And that's stuff like a user can sign up for an account. A user should be able to log in. A user will see onboarding. A new user will see onboarding.
We've had a show in the past where we talked to the code ship team, right? And that's some of what they automate too, is that once you do this well, you know, which might take some time or whatever, but once you do it, then it becomes this kind of invisible thing. It does it like every time you commit code, it just checks. You know, isn't that nice?
It's kind of I mean, I think the hard part there is writing the test and making sure you wrote it right and it's
right.
Good.
It's always the problem. That's what somebody really needs to solve. write my test for
automated
me.
Test writing, not just automated testing, automated test writing. I
gotta read your mind.
I would like that too, but because that's the thing too, is like, I now see tests as sort of like two-factor auth for your code. It's kind of like, okay, I wrote the code, it does what it does, but the test also needs to make sure the code does what it does. Like I'm going to write test code in it, and it's going to use my code. And if the test, you know, it's like it makes sure what you wrote gives the expected output. And so
talk to some like bank people one time that I think would like, if there's any people like that, like laugh at our conversations like this, because they're in such a different mindset. Like the code they write is so mission critical that they don't ever write code and then make sure that they test it.
Yeah.
They write tests, a lot of them, and then they write code
Yeah, and they probably have meetings about the test. They're like, okay, everyone look over this test code. Does it...
There's like 200% test coverage of code.
This is my banking website developer voice. Hello. Hi. Hi. I'm my Uncle Scott, because my Uncle Scott works on a banking website. It's interesting. I think the front end, you really skate around some of the testing responsibilities. I know I do. It's on my list of shame. It's been on the list of shame since we started Shop Talk. If you could just, make sure any mission critical things are tested and have backup tests, that's good. And, there is kind of this full other end, and somebody we should maybe get on the show, Micah Godbolt, talks a lot about kind of front end ops sort of stuff, architecture. But he does a lot of visual regression testing. And he has some posts on that, but it's basically you have the browser like Phantom go through and take screenshots of your page. And then it takes a page after your changes. And then it says, it doesn't like pass or fail you, but it just says like, okay, here's like, look at these. Like, I guess you could make it pass or fail, but like, look at these two pages. Is this right? Like, this page changed a lot.
I've heard two things about that. One is it's just full of false positives. And the other is that like the way to do one of the benefits of doing that is like during a refactor, not so much on like day-to-day development, but like we need to change a bunch of CSS and we want to make sure that you don't
fork anything up
when we do it.
Right. Right. I think that's good. I think it's important to have like some kind of check, robot checking, but I think, write down the process that you currently have. You work, you notify stakeholder, they look, they critique, they send it back. I mean, that's all just design, iterative design work. But you need to know what you want to check, like what's important. And so, I don't know. This is tough too. Like, at what point does a code review and start, or when does a code review end in a QA start, or design review end in a QA start, because you're kind of just handing off your changes and seeing if they look good and thumbs up. But
that's tough. I know we've given you like no answers here, but
yeah,
it's like you already know what your journey needs to be, it sounds like. So
yeah, I mean,
good luck, Josh.
Yeah, one thing I do with my coworkers is I share tunnels like through ngrok or forward. And I'm just like,
see, I have a list. I've been meaning to do a blog post on this. What are all the options for that? That's a rabbit hole we don't need to go down.
Yeah,
ngrok is one.
Ngrok, tunnel, local tunnel, and forward is another one. But they're great because you're just like, look at my machine. This URL goes down in 30 minutes because I'm going on break or something. So it puts a time cap on when somebody has to give you feedback. But then it's also like, look at this. If it looks good to you, I can send it up. So you haven't even made a commit. You're just saying like pre-commit QA this and let me know how this is working. And I've gotten a lot of great feedback from my coworkers and clients, kind of like, oh, that's good, that's good, that's good. Or if you hit a problem, you share that, it's really good. So I would do stuff like that. Like that's almost like inter-office communication stuff, because it's mostly just like you're sharing your thing. No surprises are going up on the internet. You're sharing it before it goes out. So I think that's good. Anyway, Morgan Steele, if that is your real name, that's such a power name. Here we go. Writes in, I'm looking for a little accessibility advice. An image in a link must have an alt text or accompanying text to describe the purpose of the link. 95% of the time, this makes sense. However, my department puts on a couple events where we take pics with Santa and other quick staged images with lots of people. These photos are available for download online. We have a page with large thumbnails and you click to download the image. We don't know who is in the image. They are all the same setup with different people. Also, labeling them and all click to download would create non-distinguishable links. What are your thoughts on how to proceed?
That seems so. We're not just talking about an image tag with alt text. We're talking about a tag with an image tag in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the title or the, you know, so there needs to be some kind of identifying information there. Yeah. And it doesn't sound like you know, you don't have any. You
right.
can say an image, a Santa picture, but saying click, I mean, if you don't have data, the problem is that you don't have data. So you need to solve the get the data somehow problem. And if you can't, then click to download might be as good as you can do.
Yeah, I mean, click to download is probably bad because if you just like went through on a screen reader, it'd just be like click to download, click to download, click to download, click to download. You know, like it wouldn't make much sense. But if you have an anchor tag A with IMG in the middle and you have alt text on the IMG, that it'll say link, whatever the alt text is. So like if I have a cat doing a backflip, it would say link, cat doing backflip. And
maybe it could have some kind of EXIF data from the photo, like photo taken on July 13th, 10:18 a.m.
Yeah, you could do the photo. You know, on this one, you almost maybe want to just do the image name. You know, if you're kind of like, I'm trying to think of like the use case here, like, you know, hey, Don, that's maybe too close to home because I'm working with a blind developer named Don, but Don, like, go grab photo 1081 from the Christmas party photos and set and then put it in this page. Don wouldn't know what it is with click to download, but he would know photo 1081 or something like that. Where it would be awesome, and I've seen some people using this, is if when you upload it, you have to supply a title or alt text, not just photo 86, but like some kind of descriptive alt text, like people in room with Santa, people in a room hugging Santa,
right,
or something. Like, hopefully there would be some like different alt text. There are some like machine learning APIs that you could maybe put into your app. That's a lot of action.
Cool. I mean, I was assuming that you don't have any data, but if the file name is different, maybe use the file name there. Or this sounds really fancy. Send it through some image service to identify what's in the photo and then put that in the alt text.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a website from Microsoft, captionbot.ai. And you can just upload a photo and it'll try to tell you what's in that photo. It's not the best and it's not perfect because robots are doing this, but like, you know, I don't know. Like see what it is. It you hit an API with the image and then you get things back. So
let's see what Cloudinary has. They have crazy image APIs too. I don't really see one that says tell me what's in this, but like it's definitely the type of thing that's on their radar.
You kind of want to be you kind of like want to make sure you're not filling it up with garbage. Like, and this is maybe where we all need to learn how to use screen readers kind of. It just like kind of learn what that output is going to be and see if it's annoying to you. If you're running through it with a screen reader, that's great. Chrome has these new accessibility tools kind of enabled by default, I think, or maybe it used to be a browser plugin, but now it's enabled by default. It'll like say like what it's spoken as. And I'm not seeing it. So maybe it is like a whole entire, it's a plugin. There's also like, yeah. Yeah, I'm not seeing it. Or maybe you have to do... I forget. Sorry. But yeah, it's... I'll try to find a link for it later. But it's... Like, you can use your browser tool to see what the browser is going to speak to you. Yeah.
I'd like... I still... Just the other day, I was trying to use just the built-in Mac one VoiceOver.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't have the chops yet. I was like, I gave myself an hour to be like, okay. I wanted to do is I had this little demo, which I'm using as part of a workshop. I'm going to do this, just like a fun little aside, really quick, hopefully, that's like, we have three boxes and we need to set them right next to each other. And what are all the ways in web design to do that, of which there are many, Dave. And one of them is, I just think it's a fun little exercise. One of them is just a literal table element, you know, mm-hmm. with three TDs in it. And I put three TDs right next to each other, and they say box, box, box. And here's another way, flex box, for example. You know, div, div, div. They all say box, box, box inside of it. And I was like, how do I put this in there with no other HTML or anything? I want the screen reader to, like, read me this whole page and, like, see what the difference for the output is, because presumably assistive technology like VoiceOver would announce that it's inside of a table and stuff, but it didn't seem to be doing that. And I was like, I don't know. I just don't get it. I need to, like, level up or take a course. And I even took the, like, the VoiceOver introduction thing, but it didn't really cover, like, how to navigate a website with VoiceOver very well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
We have some tools over at the
you can't just tab, because tab is like moves to links and buttons and stuff. It doesn't just tab to just any old div.
Yeah, there's like weird key commands. Every screen reader is different, but you know, it's like command shift A will read all of the page or something like. But then there's like this thing called the rotor, command shift U, I think it is, but like it's and it that's how an actual non-sighted person would use it. They would be like, okay, how am I going to surf this web page? Probably by headings, so I find what I want, or by links, or, you know, and so you or by form elements or something, or ARIA landmarks. I don't want to hear the navigation again. I just want to go straight to the content. So this rotor is what it's called in VoiceOver is pretty, I mean, it's great visualization of how it actually works. Like you look at what you're browsing and you have to kind of listen. Like maybe close your eyes and listen, but then just like look, you can also look at it and see if it makes sense. Like, does this like does the markup make sense? Does what it's reading and spitting out make sense? And it's tough, I won't lie, but it's also just very critical to get it right. People need to sort of, I don't know, your content needs to be perceivable, which would be kind of the way, the accessibility term for it. So anyway, I hope that helps. I mean, what's weird is you're trying to add like accessibility. I will say that you're trying to add accessibility non-sighted accessibility to an otherwise very visual tool, like a photo downloader. So you kind of have to just put your mindset into the non-sighted user mindset, like what would be most helpful there. So anyway, I hope that helps, Morgan.
This show is sponsored in part by, and a huge warm welcome to, HelloSign, HelloSign.com. Maybe you've used them because somebody sent you a document electronically to sign. You can sign through HelloSign, literally your signature, a legally binding signature. They're the real deal. It's so awful when somebody sends you a thing that's like, print this out and then sign the thing that you print out and then scan it and then send me back like a crooked, crappy JPEG of the thing that you signed, and then we'll print it out and put it. Ugh. No, if this feels like the future, it feels like the way things are supposed to be, you send me a document, I can sign it right on my computer, send it back to you in 2 seconds. There's no like 5 weeks of me groaning and trying to find a printer and all that stuff. No, it's fast, it's beautiful, it's great. That's what HelloSign does. Best in the business for that kind of thing. You can do all that stuff on HelloSign.com. Send people to HelloSign, have them do the thing. Or you can use their API to embed documents directly on your website, like a total white label kind of thing, and have people work that way. So, like, why do you even need this? Maybe you're a lawyer and there's, like, you know, clients that need to have things signed. Maybe you're a realtor and they need to sign things. You're an HR department. You have new hires. You're onboarding. You need their signatures for things. There's all kinds of reasons you'd need a signature. Have them do it right on your own site. Really nice experience. It's the same kind of thing of, like, why payment APIs have, you know, like, never leave my website to check out is a much more seamless, nice experience. That's like HelloSign. Never leave the site. Get the signatures right there. They have all these great integrations, too. You can send somebody an email, and there's a sign button in Gmail, and you click it and open up, and they sign the document without ever leaving Gmail. How awesome is that? Same thing with Google Docs and Evernote, and they have all these great integrations, too. This is the HelloSign API. Follow the show note link. to go to it and check it out. It's really pretty cool. Thanks, HelloSign. This is a really specific one we have here from Mike Wags, who asks specifically about Gulp and watching things in Gulp, which I think, you know, sometimes I use Gulp, you know, I have a couple projects right now I use Gulp and I don't even have any watching going on. I just use it. I just run it when I need it kind of thing. You know, like I have a little function that does something, and if I need it, I'll just go in the thing and type Gulp whatever, and it does Gulp whatever, and it's good. But like, a lot of people want to use Gulp as like a, it's just watching all the time and it's doing all the stuff necessary whenever I'm running my project. And I have it set up so like I type it once and it spins up a server for me and it watches all my files for me. It's a very like active Gulp process. That's a very common way to use any build tool thing too. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to watch your files, Gulp has in it gulp.watch. It's built into Gulp. I don't know that it always was, though, because there also is a gulp-watch add-on, plugin thing for it.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Wags actually specifically asks about gulp-watchify, which I think is a buddy with Browserify. So I think maybe that those two things go hand in hand. Like if you're definitely using Browserify, maybe it makes sense to use Watchify because they just know about each other. They come from the same land. But that's less confusing to me. Like, sure, okay, you're using Browserify, use Watchify, whatever. But how do you know when to use gulp.watch, the built-in gulp thing, or gulp-watch, the, you know, the plugin thingy of it? And that's harder to know about, I think, because gulp-watch is very active thing still. It's not just like, oh, Gulp's got gulp.watch now, so gulp-watch is gone, you know? No, it's got 21,000 downloads today, you know? It has 500,000 downloads this month. People are still using it. And I would just write this off as, like, confused. I don't know what the difference is, whatever. And that's what I am going to do, essentially, except for that I know that there is a difference because we use Gulp at CodePen for a new feature, and we had to use one or the other, and I forget what it was. I think it was the actual plugin, gulp-watch, because something weird was happening. Like, one of them didn't handle, like, files that just, like, showed up in the folder randomly very well. Mm. Like, it didn't watch for that as well as the other one did. Or it was something like that, you know? Or, like, a file gets deleted and it, like, didn't see it. One of them didn't see it. Or, you know, all of them should catch, like, if a file changes, because that's kind of the point. But there's different ways that things happen to the file system, and these two things do have some differences in when it sees things and when it doesn't.
I'm going to give a terrible, probably inaccurate retelling, but I think the version gulp.watch, because of some weird dependency thing, Gulp is using a very old like file system watcher. Like, it's not using the modern Chokidar dependency, which is kind of the file watcher. It's maybe using that, but like a very old version because of some weird conflict. Like Gulp would have to like go up a whole version number because of a breaking change.
Oh, okay.
But
gulp-watch does use Chokidar.
Right. So I think like you can introduce this thing and use a whole new object because you're using like a watch function, not gulp.watch. So I think like Gulp was in a position where it's like, well, we can update gulp.watch and fix that problem you're kind of describing, like files not getting caught, or like there's this other one now that fixes it. So it was kind of like, I think they chose or like are very,
yeah, just chill out with what gulp.watch and have it be less good, but at least built in. And then eventually, like, because isn't Gulp 4 still beta or is it out? No, I don't know.
Yeah.
Eventually they'll upgrade a full point release and it'll have it in there.
And that's what I think it was. It was like, in order to like upgrade this, it would be a breaking change. So you needed a whole point release. And so I think that's just A, dependency hell. Welcome to microservices. But B, it's I think it's just, I think it's a great workaround, but, yeah, I hit it on Windows. I think Windows, maybe it was, I couldn't watch files in Gulp and I didn't know why. And it was because I couldn't get this new version of Chocodar. So I traced it down to that, but I think that was maybe that was on Bash on Windows, but now it's totally fixed. So, because it was using some weird thing. So anyhow, hopefully that inaccurate retelling helps you on your path to watching files.
I like this one. This next one by Shane talks about MVC frameworks, in which we could say whatever. We don't even have to get into what MVC is or whatever, but just imagine like React or Vue or Ember or whatever. Right? Like you're using a major front-end JavaScript framework. And what those do for you is it's just everything kind of, right? Like front-end state management and templating and, you know, DOM manipulation through shadow DOM fanciness or whatever. I think it's becoming more clear why people reach for these things and use these things. But so much of that is data-based. Mm-hmm. Right, you'd use Vue if you're building like some kind of cool CRUD app thing in which that you just want it to feel really super smooth and you're moving sliders around and inputting inputs and stuff and it just feels like everything just kind of saves immediately and then you close one thing and open another thing and change some more sliders and type some more words and close it and it's data that you're playing with. That's why you'd be using one of these frameworks to begin with is for all this like fancy state that's happening all over the thing. Well, how do you get that state to begin with, like out of a database, because that's where data lives? And then like, how do you put it back once you've changed it? So Shane specifically types, I've been dabbling both front end and back end in programming a few years now. I feel like I've made some major strides. However, I'm still not super clear on how modern MVC frameworks connect to the back end or even third party APIs. Can you explain this to me like I'm five?
All right. Okay, so you're hey buddy, how are you? Okay, buddy. All right. So you build a web page and you put some JavaScript, React, let's use Vue cuz Vue is kind of cool. You write some Vue code. And Vue says I want to list this list of events. And spit that out. But I need that list of events from a backend. So I'm going to hit an API. And an API means you've configured your server. You can even do this with WordPress or Rails or something. But you've configured your server to return JSON when the request says, hey, just give me JSON. So my little... My Vue app now just says, hey, server, give me the JSON for all the events. And the JSON comes over the pipe. And then Vue says, great, I got it. I'm going to spit this out and like spit it out. There's a few ways to connect to that. You know, the most basic insecure, I guess, way would be just an open API. Like it's just a JSON machine. That's all it does is JSON, JSON, JSON. This is cool until you're popular, and then you all of a sudden your database is getting hammered, and also it's a little bit of a security thing. I, Dave Rupert, now have access to all your events in JSON form, so I can build my app using your JSON. And in some ways that's cool, but in some ways it's not. So what you have to do is then start introducing an API, which is two things. It's this JSON interface, but it's also this like authentication-y layer, and it's just, which happens, you say, hey, API, from my own API, from my own like backend, I need a key and a secret, a password, a username and a password, but they're called keys and secrets. And then you send over that key and secret, usually in like a header, like a hidden field, And you send over that key and secret to the website and or to your backend, and it looks at that and it says, okay, this is those key and secrets match. Great, you're the right person. Here's this data. Did that work? Are we okay? There's kind of, it gets a little weird from here. How do you like authenticate the user? Like how, you know, if I like I'm on this Vue app and I say, well, I want to be Dave Rupert, Davatron 5000 on this app. Now I need to go hit the server and say, log me in. And you can do that the same way you'd like click a form. You can like the API, it's not just getting data, you can also post data to it. So I post my login credentials, username, password, and this sounds really insecure, but I'm sure there's a way. But I post that data to it, and it says, okay, you look like you're the right person. Those username and passwords match. So I'm going to send back, and it can do two things. It could like set some kind of session thing in the browser. Mm-hmm. Like a
cookie. It's like a cookie, but it's literally a session.
Yeah, it could set a cookie in the browser, or it could install a token, which is kind of like a session, but maybe a little more permanent. And these are kind of JSON web tokens are kind of a thing. You can like look into it more, but it's basically just like a little key. Now it sends you back a key and says, anytime you want in this website, use this key. And now you have a key to the website, just like you have a key to your house. Does that make sense, buddy? it's confusing to me.
Kind of, but like, so let's say you have this big pile of state though that's got to come back because I've logged into Daytrip or whatever. It's more of a Rails app kind of thing, right? Not mm-hmm. a Vue app, but still, let's say it was Vue. You need a pile of state back, a bunch of JSON probably, or JSON-like structure of data. You just like AJAX for it, essentially.
Yeah.
It happens at CodePen is on the pages that we're using this type of technology for is we do the like the hidden input thing where like the data is in the database. So we just put it there mm-hmm. on when the page loads in a hidden input. Is just a chunk of JSON. And then as soon as the page loads, we're like, you see that input right there? That's your starting state. So grab it and rock and roll. And then it doesn't like keep that up to date. It just, from there on, it just does React stuff and just keeps its own state. And then when you make changes to state, we have Redux, and Redux is doing all the stuff. And part of that is like persisting that data back to the initial load of all that data is just Rails barfing it out into hidden input.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you think about like favorites or something, you should never have access to somebody else's favorites, you know, or like if you're requesting my favorites, you know. So at some point, the server is aware that you're this user, and it says, okay,
all the auth stuff is server side.
So when you give me favorites, I'm going to like look at who I think you are, and I'm going to return this favorite list of favorites for the person I think you're talking about. So, but it is complicated. Like you have all this state, you know, it's like, you know, you get into these major apps and it's, you know, you could have 10 or 12 models on that page, you know, like just you're doing like 10 things all at a time and it could get pretty gnarly, but, so how do you ferrying around that state to the backend when the backend needs to know about it? I mean, ideally you don't have to, but you know, sometimes you do. I think you guys use it a lot for your, for like your settings, right? Don't you do that? Like my user, I say, I want my code pens to look like this. And so make sure you do that. And so that's kind of a way y'all use it, huh?
Yeah, it depends on what area of the app you're in, but like it's extremely state heavy, you know. The whole app is really and it needs some kind of thing for that.
And I've done this like whole state thing, like managing state's very difficult, and I think that's what these MVC frameworks are really good for, or at least whatever.
Kind of, but they don't necessarily give you a you know, like the best way of managing it. Like there's state automatically in React and Vue. Like that's the only way you can work with it is you change state, and then it changes what it wants to change in the DOM, and it changes it on the page, and that's like a really cool paradigm and whatever, but it doesn't, there's not, it's still, it can be a little spaghetti-y still, like where you choose to change that state, just wherever you want to in React pretty much, you know? So that's when tools like Redux come in, and they're just like, no, enough with the like loosey-goosey change state wherever you want. Now, in order to change state, you have to dispatch an action in which to change state, and I'll respond to that action and change like a copy of the state, which makes it very efficient or whatever. Like, I'm not qualified to give this talk really, mm-hmm. but then it's like it's really cool because it's this really standardized way of managing that state in such a way that it's like feels like kind of impossible to screw up. Like you had to go through such ceremony to change the state that like it's absolutely going to do what's expected of it and it's testable.
Yeah, I think the conventions are huge. That's what I like about
when you're changing that state. I think you hook right into that and blast it to the database too. You know?
Yeah, like it can do both. I like frameworks or like Redux or just give convention, because I will say in JavaScript in general, what kind of drives me nuts is there's 100 ways to do everything and like there's no convention on how to kind of do something, although there people argue me there is, but there's, you know, in general it's kind of like, well, figure it out, you know, like write this function, do something, and then you do your thing, however you want to do that, it doesn't matter, just do something. And I just, you know, when I coming from like using Rails and stuff like that, it's very explicit, there's a quote unquote Rails way to kind of do everything, you know, there's like a very prescriptive way to do something. And I think, I don't know, I feel like that's missing from the JavaScript ecosystem a little bit, and that's my critique, and don't fight me, because I don't, or I will fight you. I should take the alpha. I'll be alpha on that. So I just feel like it's good because it leaves room for innovation, but there's a lot for interpretation, which isn't helpful in things like user authentication. You know what I mean? Like that shouldn't be something people are just riffing on, so... Oh, that's my spiel. Hopefully we help Shane. It's kind of tough to explain like how things lock together.
A little bit. Words. There's no prescribed answer. I feel like a lot of times MVCs they or whatever frameworks shy away from like use this exact API to send data back to your database because it doesn't know about your database. It doesn't really care about your database. It might not even have Ajax tools built into the thing. Even those might be BYO. It is a little wild west as far as like when and how you persist data and how you even get the data to begin with. It does feel a little weird to me. And I understand the confusion there because I don't totally understand it myself. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're using React and you're connecting to like Mongo, that's probably totally different than if you're using React and using Firebase or something. You know, you might even use like separate NPM packages to do that, and it just gets a little...
It's the tech is different, but your own app is the special snowflake here. This episode of Shop Talk Show brought to you in part by CodePen. We've talked to you a lot about the pro features of CodePen. I'm going to do it again because that's what I do. I work on CodePen. I'm one of the co-founders. We've asked a bunch of pro users why they upgraded, and it's a large variety of reasons, but a big one is privacy. A lot like GitHub charges for private repos. There's private pens and private collections and private posts. You get all that, all of those in an unlimited way when you upgrade to CodePen Pro. But it caught our eye in the sense of like, what can we do to make private better? And I have nothing to announce right this second other than you get all that stuff. But we have some ideas to make private better on CodePen, and those things will be coming soon, and you'll just get them the minute we release them as a pro user of CodePen. So if you are looking forward to mysterious new privacy-based features, please upgrade to CodePen Pro. I want to try to pronounce this one. Igor Kavanichka.
You got it.
Is it the thing?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Igor, thanks for writing in. A customer once asked me, why are there bugs in our software? I was trying to explain to him, while software development is very complex and while sometimes you make a mistake or there's some edge case that you didn't think about, but his question stuck in my mind. I don't think I answered his question properly. The customer's paying for the product and he expects that it will work properly. Imagine buying a loaf of bread and when you come home, you realize that it's just half baked or with big holes inside. I guess you wouldn't be happy about it and maybe wanted your money back. Basically, you'd expect quality for your money. Ever since this customer's question, I feel a bit guilty when there's bug in my software because I feel like I've disappointed the customer. So my question is, how can you apologize for bugs in your software? How would you answer a customer asking, why are there bugs in your software?
Dude, this is a thinker, huh?
Yeah.
You know, I think for me, it comes down to, there's two things, human error and also, you know, a website or any piece of software is a very complex thing. There's, you know,
you didn't ship a customer a web app that you couldn't even log into. If you did that, that's the equivalent of a half-baked loaf or a giant holes in the loaf. Like if you bring bread home and you open it up and you can't even eat that bread, that's a huge mistake. Usually we're not sending our customers unusable bread. Mm-hmm. We're sending, there's something a little bit weird, right? Like this button is a little wonky on tablets. Or like whatever, I typed in a 7 and it came out a 10. I mean, that one would be probably pretty weird or bad, but usually they're a little more nuanced than that. There's 50,000 things that can go wrong with a website, and there's kind of like two things that can go wrong with bread.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's also external factors like, you know, the operating system you're working on might also have bugs. The browser might have bugs, you know, like there's, you know, and in order for you to fix that, you have to introduce more code to handle all these edge cases. And by the fact that you're increasing the amount of code, you're increasing the kind of surface area for problems to occur. So in the act of fixing bugs, you might be introducing more bugs. Just that's the nature of code. I think it's all...
So imagine a customer like writing to a grocery store, like they went skydiving with the bread and tried to eat it while skydiving, but the bread just flew right out of their hand.
Like, yeah.
This bread did not work while skydiving.
Well, very frequently I think about coding and I'm just like, in what other profession, if you miss a semicolon, do you just get nothing? You know, like you could like write something and like miss a colon or a semicolon and you just get nothing instead of a page, you know? And I don't think people understand how kind of terse our tools are or how kind of, you know, how the codes that we type, the brackets and angles and equal signs and all that has very specific meaning. And if even a small typo can mess that up, and we don't exactly have like little grammar control to fix that, you know, so it's, you know, if I miss a typo or if I miss a semicolon in a Word document, it's not the end of the world. You may have some weird problems, but like you're not going to get nothing. Like when the Word document goes to a printer, it doesn't just turn out a white page, you know, which is how websites work. Anyway, I hope that helps. It's just weird. I think it's not,
I like that though. It's a fun thinker, you know?
Yeah. It's like, why, if you're an expert, you know, who's charging for the service of websites, like, why would there be a bug?
That happens a lot. I mean, I think about it. There's a million analogies, you know. I'm sure plumbers think about it sometimes too. And I'm exasperated by it sometimes. This actually happened to me just a couple of weeks ago. I hired a plumber to come over and I had a few things for him to look at, including the kitchen sink. And I'm like, our kitchen sink to this day, right now, it has crappy water pressure. Hmm. And then he goes and looks underneath. He's like, the water pressure looks okay. You know, and here, and I bought a brand new kitchen faucet system, you know, right from, it's a perfectly decent little one. It's got a hand sprayer and stuff right from Home Depot, you know, and I had him install that thinking like maybe it's just an old faucet. At least we'll rule out the faucet and we'll get this nice faucet while we're at it. And he couldn't get it. He couldn't get it to work. And I was like, you know, not work. It works. It just still has low water pressure. But in his opinion, the water pressure at the wall level is perfectly fine. It's just like, I don't know. And then he just gave up. And I was like, oh, well, whatever, dude. That sucks. And then he like came back and he's like, this is bothering me. I should be able to figure it out. I'm like, yeah, dude, I like your spirit here, you know, coming back to solve a problem you couldn't solve. But then he tried some other stuff and he couldn't get it to work. And he charged me anyway and then left. And to this day, we still have crappy water pressure in there. And I'm just like, that's so weird. Like, I don't mind paying for the other work that he did. It's not like I'm totally unhappy with his service, but it's kind of one of those things where like, you just couldn't do it.
Yeah. Aren't you the plumber man? Why? And if the water at the wall is fine.
And I think at that point, don't you tell me to my face, listen, I am a plumber and I have certain skills as a plumber. Of course, this is a solvable problem because houses all around the world have decent water pressure in their kitchen sinks, but I can't do it. Like, I feel like I would have some responsibility to like own up like that. Like if I'm a web developer and I don't know how to implement Firebase because I just have never done it before and it just feels outside of my skill reach, I'd be able to be like, listen, this is possible, but I don't know how to do it. I'm sorry to say it, but I'm not good enough to write this feature for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it too. I don't think people know what they ask for, and that's the other part of the question.
It's a little bit different than shipping bugs. I realize we've diverged from that topic a little.
We're now plumbing our houses, but
let's wait. We have another one from Igor. We'll save that one just to be fair to two, all our other people.
Yeah, two in a row. You can't do two in a row. No, you can, but please send more. But we won't read two in a row on the show. Here we go. Amber Lee writes in, if you are working on a website whose mobile traffic and conversion rate is low, how do you justify the additional time to create a mobile-friendly UI to stakeholders? Do you even bother if it means that development will take longer?
Mm-hmm. The normal answer to this, Amber, that I feel like you'd get from most people, which I can understand it and would probably give it under a lot of circumstances, is the old chicken and the egg thing, which is your mobile traffic and conversion rate low now because it's the experience sucks or you don't even have one? And if you did it, those metrics would go up. I mean, that stands to reason and I'm sure has borne out many times in this world of RWD.
That's what I would say. It's like, why aren't people using this turd? Well, because it's a turd.
At the same time, there's situations where it's not. CSS Tricks, for example, has almost no mobile traffic, like just none, like less than 1% these days and going down every year, I feel like. It's just not a site that people visit on mobile at all. Justifying it seems like, well, people justify things for weird ways. One, if I didn't have a responsive web design site, I'd be laughed out of town and I'd get 50 emails about it every single day because I get lots of emails about little tiny weird stuff on the site every day. So can you imagine if I just opted not to use responsive web design? That it's just like kind of not an option these days because there's still some people that do it and whatever. Like I like working on it and it just would seem weird not to and things like that. I'd realize that's just a developer on developer, just, you know, that's not a common thing, but it's just one justification. There's also, you know, there's justifications all over the place. The other thing is how much time does it really take? I don't feel like it's like this big thing in the way of how I work on websites anymore. It's just kind of how I think about building websites. So it just comes out naturally. Doesn't it for you in a way? Do you ever think about like, gosh, well, it's RWD time. Gotta spend a bunch of hours on this. Wish I didn't have to, but I got to.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. For me, it's just, it's part of how you make websites now. I mean, what website do you not want to work well on a phone? You know, everything should work well. So.
And is it this big time investment? I suppose it can be. I mean, it's not, I'm not saying that, you know, whatever, thinking about multiple screen sizes takes zero time at all. But if you just think about it as you're not just supporting one thing, you're supporting all kinds of experiences. It feels like it makes more sense. And the tools are there these days that it's just not that hard. If you use any kind of framework, it kind of handles it for you.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I like really worry about like using the current state to justify not spending time on a future state, you know, like, I don't know. We just had a VR episode. No one's using our site on VR, so why should we build a VR site? You know, it's like, well, I don't know. It's like, maybe you shouldn't, but like, if you think you're going to need it, or if you see some amount of traffic coming from VR, maybe you should do that, you know, like you should look into it. But, and I also wonder about your stats specifically, Chris. I wonder if like your audience is also using content blockers, which would super skew your mobile, you know, your mobile kind of stuff. So
my data.
Yeah.
You think so? Like it doesn't even report properly.
Yeah.
Because you're using something that blocks Google Analytics or whatever.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a false, you know.
My data's a problem.
Your data's always munged.
Yeah.
And that's my problem with data-driven decisions, too, is sometimes your data's really bad and you don't know it till too late. So,
yeah. I don't know. And there's no mechanism to, like, fix the data or...
No, you can't fix it unless you wanted to, like, hand coal server logs for
I posted a book review. I'd love to get the author of this on, but I posted a mini book review on this book called Weapons of Math Destruction, like the play on words, WMD. Mm-hmm. It was a really interesting book, but it had some stuff like that in it about how algorithms are data-based, you know, and it's like a bad algorithm can do all kinds of nasty stuff. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's a WMD unless there's no mechanism in which to teach that algorithm to be better or fix the data behind it. And that so many algorithms are like not bad in this regard because there is that feedback loop present. For example, advertising ones, like of course there's algorithms like for Amazon to show you what product to buy. And this is just taken right from the book. Like, you know, you buy a lawnmower and it shows you a gas can and it shows you some oil and it shows you a weed whacker or whatever, right? Because there's a pretty good chance that you'd also want to buy those kind of things if you just bought a lawnmower, which stands to reason. And if that algorithm started showing you like Elvis records or something, like maybe those would do good, but maybe that's so unrelated that it does really poorly. Amazon's going to see the fact that those conversions are really bad from showing you those products. And thus there's a loop present to have the incentive to fix that data and fix the algorithm. But a lot of times there isn't that loop, you know, like if I just trust exactly the data in Google Analytics about my mobile stuff and then just make decisions based on it, there's no loop to teach me better. There's no evidence to incentivize me to fix the problem.
Right. Well, you almost need to kind
of
like...
That's a bit of a stretch, I realize.
No, I mean, you kind of just need to like make your best guess, you know, like come up, like kind of... figure out what the problem is and make your best guess. I mean, if you can like, everyone like looks at the mobile site and they're like, ugh, this thing's ugly, dude. Well, let's not fix it because the data's bad. I think you made a bad decision. I think it's just like, if everyone knows it's bad, like spend some time on it. Like,
what if you blew it out? What does it look like, Amber, to like, let's say this is a bit of an e-commerce site or you can check out or buy something on there. What if you made like a mobile form that was like your call to action that was so awesome on mobile that it just was a beautiful user experience. And, you know, like, what do you think, what happens then? Like, try that and see what it's like. Or like have a mobile checkout process in which you use Braintree or whatever, and it has like Apple Pay integration. So all, yeah, and Android Pay and all the like fancy mobile checkout, you know, Microsoft Wallet or whatever it is. And like the checkout experience is just super painless, you know, like it asks the browser what address you have and it pre-fills that and then asks for a payment method that it already has. And it makes checkout like easier than even desktop web. Like, what's that going to do to you? Like, you know, or is your conversion rate still going to be bad?
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably not. Right.
Yeah. It's like if we made a better experience, is it gonna be better. There's I don't know exactly know which one it would be, but there's a great podcast with Jeff Veen, who's also been on the show, called Presentable, over on Relay.fm/presentable. And they talk about these kinds of just design issues and how to, like, there's this really good one about design ethics from and the race to the bottom of the brainstem with Tristan Harris. And they're like, he was a design ethicist at Google. And it's just cool. They don't talk about this issue specifically, but they talk about kind of like making decisions with data and like, but are you doing it for the user? You know, like, does this benefit the user, or is it just benefit our pocketbooks or whatever? So something to consider. It's interesting using data to make decisions. So
let's do let's call that the last question, and yeah. I'm going to do a little bit of Twitter wrap up, because we've had some good at replies listen. So we do, of course, watch Twitter. We're not like super duper active on it because Dave and I have our own accounts and business accounts and stuff. And Shop Talk Show goes a little neglected, but I do have it installed in my Twitter client and look at every single reply posted to it. So there was an interesting one. Aaron Gustafson was watching, and we were talking about grid layout and like the fallback for more modern layout things. And I was like, oh, it's always kind of annoying with at supports, where you have to like, you put all this layout code within an at supports block, but outside of the at supports block is your fallback. So inside that supports block, you have to like reset all the stuff that you did in case it interferes with the new stuff you're doing. And it's a lot of like fighting yourself CSS that doesn't feel great. And he mentioned that all property of CSS, which is it has the ability to unset everything,
yeah,
on one particular element. So that's a possibility. It seems like then you're also kind of fighting yourself, because you've like killed the cascade too, so you'd have to reset like fonts and all that stuff. But still, if you really want to start from scratch there, that's a possibility and an interesting thought. Thanks, Aaron. Jonathan Snook, also been on the show, wrote in about the $2,000 question. That was a fun little, like, how do we waste $2,000 on tech? He said he'd spend it on phones and tablets to fill out a personal device lab. That's kind of fun, because that's fun anyway. Like, I remember I used to have like a Kindle Fire sitting around that I used to like pick up and play with once in a while. It was an excuse to have like kind of a weird browser and a weird size and stuff. Sometimes that's just kind of like, it's good for professional, but it, you know, for your professional life, but it's also just kind of fun. Not a bad idea.
No, I think that's a great idea.
We had a lot of, another person suggested a really nice chair. That's cool. And links to a Herman Miller chair. I've had bad experience. I ponied up for one time when I felt flush and felt like I do so much sitting that it's like I should go. And I didn't like it that much. I still have it, but I like have some other like Office Max chair that I sit in because I just like it better, which maybe is stupid, but whatever. I didn't find the Herman Miller chair that compelling. We had lots of tweets about the show.
I'm going to disagree. I have it.
Yeah. I have Herman Miller on. And you love it.
It's saved my butt.
I have an air on. I'll sell you an Aeron. Somebody want to buy
really?
An Aeron?
Me. I might take you up on that.
Well, you don't need two, but if you do need
Why
two.
Not? One for my feet. No.
lots of tweets about our security episode, too. Mm-hmm. That one went over well, and it felt good, too. There was a lot of stuff. So if you just are listening to this show and don't listen to all the shows, which I totally understand, there's a lot of podcasts out there, go back and listen to that one, because that was a particularly interesting one.
Yeah. That one haunts me, man. I'm still like, oh, I got to fix things.
Us too, because there's some basic stuff at CodePen that we have partially there, and then some stuff that was there and we had to remove temporarily. And it's really given us new enthusiasm to make sure that we're doing more.
And we do now have HTTPS on shoptalkshow.com. Hey.
Yeah, you know what I should blog about? Because you're the one who turned me onto this. It was, we had a problem. There was one page that really needed to be that wasn't or whatever. And, you know, I've played around. It's a WordPress site, and I've played around with that before. It's really easy to force it on the admin side. Even if you're not ready on the front end of a site, to enable it for all the back end stuff is still a big win, you know? So you might, and there's less like, you know, when you're in the back bench of the site, it's not loading up a bunch of arbitrary resources like the front end is. So it's easier to turn on. Dave taught me, you go to Plesk, there's a Let's Encrypt plugin for Plesk, and not all servers have Plesk, but ours happens to, you know, because it's a Media Temple DB server that just happens to have Plesk installed, which is like server management backend software. I don't know. I never mind working in Plesk. I think it enables a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, it's a pretty good. It's like, as far as these those like server managers go, it's pretty good.
Yeah, which are from terrible to awful, you know, like it's not like an interface that you're going to fall in love with, believe me, it's not. But it gets done what you need to get done, and in this case I was happy because there's plugins that enable even more functionality in it, and there's a Let's Encrypt one. You download a zip file, you right through the web interface install the Let's Encrypt plugin, you say I want an SSL certificate for this domain, clickety clack, it installs it and it works. And all of a sudden, Shop Talk Show is HTTPS. We have not forced it for every page of the site because we just have a little bit of work to do. And we're a little worried about this podcast, to be honest, as in the URLs for the MP3s themselves. If we go start forcing the MP3s to be HTTPS, which would be a good idea, but it's going to trick all of your pod readers that the episode has changed and you might just get a deluge of changed podcast, which is annoying.
Yeah, we don't want to do that where you have to like re-download every episode of Shop Talk, and we don't want to like break functionality where like, because right now there's thousands and thousands of podcatchers connected to Shop Talk Show's feed, and so like if we change something, there's a chance they wouldn't ever get the update. And so you don't want to do that. You don't want
you're right. The feed URL itself definitely can't change. Mm-hmm. Or can it, or what? Cause it, we just can't for, I don't know.
I can't like just hot switch it. Cause I get all nervous. So, anyway, I heard about a podcast that did it and they had problems. So,
it'd be good for those of you out there who, for example, are using a browser extension that forces HTTPS, which is cool on sites that offer both. You know, you might as well be forcing it. Like that's how it works on CodePen too. You can visit any of CodePen with HTTPS if you want to. It's just we don't force it because it's annoying. Is you could visit a pen that's linking up an insecure resource and it doesn't load and it's not you're not sure why. And anyway, we have plans for all this stuff. Believe me, we talk about it all the time. It's just not there yet, and we're going to have a plan and announce it soon. But whatever, on Chop Talk Show, everything should work fine.
Yeah, it should be doing good. It's just, yeah. Yeah, I thank you for pardon our dust. Is that what we say? Pardon our dust.
There we go.
Underconstruction.gif. So, all right. Well, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this and your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Tweet about the show. Follow us at shoptalkshow.com or at shoptalkshow on Twitter for 10 tweets a month. And like Chris said, we're reading them. We're just not so good at Twitter with this one. That's okay. And then what else, Chris? If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, you got anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.